You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9:59 a.m. Next up is American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.
So take heart and take care of your link with life. It's beautiful.
Good morning. This is Jacqueline Keeler, and I'd like to welcome you to American Standoff. We are a fairly new KBOO show. We started on January 6th this year. That looks at the current political divide in America from an Indigenous perspective, given by myself, Jacqueline Keeler, a Native journalist based here in Oregon. And so it's been a year and almost over 3 months since January 6, 2021, when thousands of supporters of former President Trump gathered in D.C. and then stormed the Capitol to contest President Biden's election and to try to, let's face it, overturn the election. And that's what we're going to really discuss today, particularly the role of insurrectionists and militia groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. And these are groups that are familiar to us here, not only in Portland, but in Oregon. In my book, Standoff, which came out last year and looks, it kind of compares the takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in 2016 to what happened at Standing Rock, will contrast it, you know, a armed standoff by white men mostly, and contrasted to the violent response to a nonviolent stand against the Dakota Access Pipeline by Lakota, led by Lakota people in North Dakota. And so we're familiar with these groups and the role they have played in these things in our own state. And if you read my book, Standoff, you'll see a lot more detail into the role that the Oath Keepers, the three percenters in these groups, played at Malheur at the Wildlife Refuge in 2016. And so today on the show, we're discussing recent texts that have emerged in which members of a right-wing militia group sought protection for a Texas representative believed to have, quote, critical data, right? This occurred at the same time former President Donald Trump supporters were had violently breached the Capitol on January 6th. And these were released on Monday, so it's still newsworthy. It's Thursday. On this show, we examine the connections between seemingly disparate events like this and their origins in white supremacy and the DNA of colonialism and the ongoing occupation of indigenous homelands in the United States. And so, as I mentioned earlier, my name is Jacqueline Keeler. I'm your host, and please do call in. This is a call-in show. So the number here is 503-231-8187. So on Monday night, a late-night court filing charged Edward Vallejo, 63, and other anti-government oath keepers, militia members, being in near constant contact in the days leading up to January 6th. And on January 6th, when hundreds of Trump supporters overran police at the Capitol and temporarily stopped Congress from certifying Joe Biden's win in the 2020 presidential election. So let's listen to some coverage of these texts and what they mean regarding the coordination of the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, and a member of Congress, and Trump.
Sixth committee is going through all of this evidence they're getting in. More than 850 witnesses have sat for an interview so far. One thing that they've begun to discuss is not just recommendations for changing the Electoral Count Act, which has been widely reported because Donald Trump and his allies tried to exploit that statute to have him stay in power. But now they're looking at whether or not there needs to be changes to the Insurrection Act as well. And that's for a few reasons. One, Donald Trump repeatedly threatened to use the Insurrection Act in ways many people found disturbing in 2020. And then in the final days of his presidency, extremists were urging him to invoke the Insurrection Act to stay in power. Stuart Rhodes, the leader of the Oath Keepers, wrote an open letter urging the invocation of the Insurrection Act, and other extremists, other Oath Keepers were chatting amongst themselves on text groups and on Facebook Messenger about anticipating the invocation of martial law when they would then come into the Capitol on January 6th. So the committee is gathering this evidence and they're saying, we came very dangerously close here, and does this law need to be changed? I think there's debate on both sides of that, but perhaps some believe there should be a consultation with Congress before a president can invoke the act. Perhaps there needs to be a stronger definition before a president can invoke the act. And these are the discussions that are ongoing right now.
Well, Carol Lenning, your book reports that the extremists weren't the only people checking social media about Donald Trump's sort of state of mind about the Insurrection Act. Deny alone can fix it. You write this. General Milley told his staff that he believed Trump was stoking unrest, possibly in hopes of an excuse to invoke the Insurrection Act and call out the military. The night of January 2nd, Milley got a heads up from a former defense secretary that all 10 living former defense secretaries had reached the same conclusion. Because Milley was on high alert about January 6th, he had been monitoring Dataminer, an app that tracks specific news reports or Twitter alerts on subjects of one's choosing. Milley was checking it several times a day, looking for any sign of electoral protest, plans for civil unrest, or nutty calls for martial law that Mike Flynn may have stirred up. The general knew that a small spark could set off a blaze. So this isn't just a concern of the 1-6 committee. This was a concern at the highest levels of the U.S. military.
Absolutely, Nicole. And, you know, what we've learned in our reporting around the time of that book was that Mark Milley told confidants that when Michael Flynn, remember, President Trump's most loyal enabler, and the person who used to be his national security advisor until he had to be fired in disgrace for lying to the FBI and facing possible criminal liability, that there were shivers going through the Defense Department, sort of the brass, because on December 17th and 16th, Michael Flynn was publicly saying that the President of the United States should invoke the Insurrection Act, declare martial law, and quote unquote, rerun the election by seizing the machines, voting machines, and basically in all swing states, just running it over again. This is the kind of thing you hear in countries where dictators are in charge. And that's why people like Mark Milley, but many others in the Pentagon, Nicole, were on tenterhooks worrying about this. And I should argue that they were not ill-advised in being worried about just Michael Flynn's public commentary on a conservative news site. They had personally experienced Donald Trump's repeated efforts to pressure them to say it's time now to invoke the Insurrection Act. Keep in mind, Donald Trump, throughout the summer of unrest over the killing of George Floyd by police, he had said, look, this is a way for me to look strong. I'm going to come out against these Black Lives Matter protesters, and I'm going to look tough. And the Insurrection Act is the way to do that. Mark Esper basically threw his body in front of that. Mark Milley threw his body in front of that. Mark Esper being, of course, the former defense secretary, and at the time publicly was so upset about it, he gave a news conference infuriating the president by saying that he was opposed to the use of the Insurrection Act. I think Luke's right in describing that there's two views on all of this now about whether or not the panel that's investigating the insurrection should or should not recommend changes to when a president can invoke the act, because you can take away really important power from a responsible president while trying to take power out of the hands of a potential future rogue president.
It's such a fascinating balance to watch them try to strike. And Luke, my question, I guess in normal times would seem irrelevant, but is this bipartisan? I mean, are the Republicans for this too? Do the Republicans recognize how close Mark Esper and Mark Milley, not exactly, you know, leftists in any of these political conversations, even as they get perverted on the right, do the Republicans understand there's a problem here? Are they participating in any efforts to tweak the act itself?
I'm told that any recommendation that comes out of the committee will be a unanimous one, so they will reach an agreement. There were diverging views on the committee when this matter came up in 2020. There were some Republican votes. Well, there was one Republican vote for reforming the Insurrection Act, and there were a handful of Democrats who voted against a change to it when it was on the floor of the House. That said, the end of the Donald Trump presidency presented new dangers in the minds of many that were not present for that vote. When you think about Mike Flynn, Sidney Powell, and others sitting in the Oval Office advocating for the seizure of voting machines, and we know from reporting that Donald Trump tried several different avenues to see if different agencies would be willing to seize voting machines, the Trump presidency presented new troubles for democracy that probably were not anticipated for previous presidents. So you have a set of laws here, and a person doesn't necessarily fit the normal mode of a presidency. So it is a difficult question for Congress. How do you legislate to try to ensure something like this doesn't happen again, especially if Donald Trump is returned to office?
So that was a different audio than I had planned on sharing. I wanted to share Ari Melber's his sort of overview of the issue. That's fine. We can begin with that, because that's actually what I wanted to close with. But maybe it's good to open with it, you know. So this is what I wanted to bring up at the end of the show, and that this is sort of a solution, some of the different solutions that are go beyond simply arresting and charging conspirators of the Capitol insurrection. How do we, you know, there's obviously, you know, ways in which Trump and his associates were attempting, they're piecing together, the January 6th committee are piecing together how exactly Trump and his associates, including apparently militia groups like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, how they were utilizing our system of laws in order to overthrow the government, to do a coup, you know, and sort of documenting it in detail. And so that was an interview on NBC yesterday with the New York Times congressional reporter Luke Broadwater and Washington Post national investigative reporter Carol Leonig discussing the January 6th committee considering changes to the Insurrection Act after uncovering evidence of Trump's behavior around January 6th. And so, I definitely recommend Carol Leonig's books, I Alone Can Fix It, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year, which is a very good look at more detail on that as well. And so, but good morning. So this is American Standoff. We're a live talk radio show, and as you can tell, we are live. And so do call into the studio if you want to be part of this conversation at 501-8187. My name is Jacqueline Keeler. I'm your host. And I'd like to say hello in Navajo. We say yacht eh. And, you know, and so she'e Jacqueline Keeler, yeshia. My name is Jacqueline Keeler. And in the Navajo way, we also introduce ourselves through our clans. Each of my grandparents have their own clan, which we trace matrilineally, not patrilineally. And so I am also a citizen of the Navajo Nation. We call ourselves Diné, the Diné people. Through my father, I am also Yankton Sioux. My father was an enrolled member of the Yankton Sioux tribe. And in the Dakota language, we say Ihanktamon Dakota. Yankton Sioux is Ihanktamon. So my clan is Kia'ani Nishlis, which is Towering House people, one of the original clans of the Navajo people. And I am born for my father's people, which are the Yankton Sioux people, the Ihanktamon Dakota people. I'd also like to acknowledge that we are broadcasting this show in Portland, Oregon, which are the located on the ancestral lands of the Multnomah, Wasco, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Cowlitz bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kayapuya, Malala, and many other tribes. And so the question I ask every episode of the show is in the more than the year that has passed since January 6, 2021, when we all saw the storming of the Capitol, what have we learned as a people, as a country, as individuals, right? And this is what I'd like to invite you to be part of this discussion. What are your feelings on this? What do you feel when you hear news like this? And it's bombarding us. It's coming at us all the time. And it can be hard to process. It can be easy to shut down and not pay attention. And I think it's very important because what drove these folks what drives these folks like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and Michael Flynn and all these Trump associates is to a large degree a form of narcissism and different things like that. But it's also, you know, they're basing their arguments in sort of the concept of America, of what it means to be an American. And so in that way, it affects all of us, even myself as someone who is an unwilling American, right? My people do not consent to being part of this country and having our lands occupied. And so it was through violence and genocide and the continued militarized occupation of our lands, which I go into a lot of detail in my book Standoff, as far as how I see the what happened at Standing Rock as the violent nature of the military occupation of the Dakota people, of the Dakota territories, of our homelands, made it visible. You could actually see it. And when you see the lack of violence used against, say, the largely white crowds that committed the insurrection on January 6, 2021 in the capital of the United States, you know, just the being overwhelming, the Capitol Police. And you contrast how, you know, measured the response was to the takeover at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge here in Oregon in 2016, which I contrast in my book Standoff to the very heavily militarized assault on the nonviolent, water protectors at Standing Rock, you begin to see the elements, the outlines of power in this country, how it works, right? And so so what we're looking at today we're discussing newly released court documents, which feature a series of texts between members of the far-right Oath Keepers discussing how to provide security for a much larger group of Trump allies than previously known. So the exchanges between the militia group, the Oath Keepers, are of them discussing providing security for Michael Flynn, who is the former Trump National Security Advisor, and also for Stop the Steal organizer Ali Alexander, and far-right radio host Alex Jones, along with other individuals and groups tied to former President Trump. So the documents, they were filed as part of a case against Oath Keepers member Ed Vallejo, who himself held a stockpile of 30 days' worth of weapons and ammunition in nearby Virginia as the attack at the Capitol was underway. So he was standing by in Virginia, not that far from Washington, D.C., with a stockpile of 30 days' worth of weapons and ammunition. That kind of clearly delineates their state of mind, right? And so Politico was the first reported on this court filing, and which was made because Vallejo is seeking a pretrial release. So he's seeking to, you know, not be in jail before the trial. The text shows Stuart Rhodes, the founder of the Oath Keepers, who is himself facing seditious conspiracy charges, discussing the group's plans to provide personal security detail, which he called PSD, personal security detail, for several figures involved in planning for the rally that day. Right. So this time around, this is him in these series of texts. He says, this time around, we have requests for PSD for Ali Alexander. He's had death threats and is asking for a two-man dedicated, means Oath Keepers, PSD detail from Bianca Latinos for Trump, Rhodes said, adding that a patriot billionaire was also seeking assistance. Bottom line is that, Stuart Rhodes, of course, bottom line is those of you wanting to do PSD details will get plenty of opportunity. We may also end up assisting the PSD for Alex Jones again, which was a great feather in our cap. We worked superbly with both Alex Jones' security team, who are awesome guys, he said. Rhodes goes on to reference another far-right group, First Amendment Praetorian, that, like the Oath Keepers, has been subpoenaed by the House Committee investigating the attack on the Capitol. So this is a group called First Amendment Praetorian. That's kind of like the Praetorian Guard that guarded, I guess, the Roman Emperor. And they love working with us because of our legit, quiet, professional demeanor and skill sets. This is Stuart Rhodes again. It's incredibly important for us to be front and center, he says, and very visible for the patriots and to domestic enemies, which I guess means all other Americans that don't support this violent takeover. Heck, also to our foreign enemies, he says, we will surely be watching as well. So this is that's a different sort of tone to it all. It wasn't this spontaneous thing that happened. It was meant to send a message, right? A message to Americans who do not support folks like Stuart Rhodes and Alex Jones, and a message to our foreign folks. It's to the international scene, right? And we've seen the impact that it's had. You know how this plays out in foreign policy, right? We saw Trump withholding holding weapons to Ukraine in exchange for trying to get President Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, to dig up more dirt on Joe Biden's son, and then sends a message to Putin and to other folks that certain things are allowed. It allows this sort of violence to grow internationally. So this is not just a matter for us internally; it is also a matter for us in foreign policy as well. So the United States is not perfect. United States does not always, in no way, I'm not saying lives up to its ideals internationally either, you know, but it still does send a message to foreign despots. So the House panel had initially sought to question the Oath Keepers over their security support for Trump confidant Roger Stone. So that's sort of where that is. These texts definitely suggest an eagerness to provide security for Flynn. They also show that Oath Keeper members were perhaps not as out front and center as they would have liked. So they would have liked to have been a lot more, visible, a lot more publicly linked to figures like Flynn and Roger Stone. And so an Oath Keeper member, Kelly Meggs, Meg pipes in, I can have a team there for the fifth, they're basically, you know, coordinating this sort of support and sort of a militia detail for figures associated with Trump. And the one that made most of the headlines was that the Oath Keeper members on January 6th discussed how to aid Representative Ronny Jackson, right, a Republican congressman from Texas and a former White House doctor under Trump. And this is Dr. Ronny Jackson on the move, needs protection. If anyone inside can cover him, he has critical data to protect. I don't know what this critical data was. Maybe it was they were constantly claiming they had information that would let them show that the election was being stolen. And so Rhodes replies, give him my cell, right? So there's evidence of a connection. So once again, we are discussing recent texts connecting the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys to Trump's team on the day of the Capitol insurrection. Please call in to be part of this conversation. Our studio number is 503-231-8187. And this is American Standoff, and I am Jacqueline Keeler, your host. So let's listen to an interview with the Guardian reporter who broke this story. We have some audio of the Guardian reporter with, I think, being interviewed by Ari Melber.
And as the Guardian reports, the investigation is starting to focus on the coordination between far-right military gangs and their actions leading up and during the insurrection. In fact, a new court filing reveals text messages showing that the head of the Florida Oath Keepers chapter, Kelly Meggs, called the jailed leader of the Proud Boys, and it shows them coordinating protection services for Donald Trump ally Roger Stone. But we are also seeing for the first time that the Oath Keepers mentioning, as the January 6th riots were underway, a newly elected Trump-loving member of Congress in their text, none other than Dr. Ronny Jackson. Quote, Dr. Ronny Jackson on the move, needs protection. If anyone inside, cover him. He has critical data to protect. Hugo Lowell is a congressional reporter for The Guardian who has been covering the investigation into January 6th. He joins me now. Hugo, it's great to see you again. You reached out to Dr. Jackson about this story and others. How did he respond to the text in this filing?
Yeah, so we got a statement through his office earlier this morning that he was not involved with any of the aforementioned groups, so the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, and that he had never spoken to any of these people, which I thought was interesting because obviously these were text messages and it seemed to be that there was some sort of connection between the Oath Keepers and Ronny Jackson, and during the Capitol attack, maybe that was through text. So I put that question back to his office and did not receive a response.
So is there any plan by the January 6th committee to call Republican members into Congress like Ronny Jackson? Is there anything that, you know, under oath he may be compelled to offer up?
Well, it's a good question, and I think the Select Committee is still trying to decide what they want to do with the Republican members of Congress and whether they want to bring them in before the committee. You know, back in January, I was hearing murmurs among the members on the committee and among the staff that they were really concerned about the political implications of bringing in members of Congress, right? Members of Congress protected by the so-called speech and debate clause. It's really hard to overcome that and to subpoena these members without it turning into a real partisan fight. And, you know, the committee has looked at this and thought, well, if it's going to be a partisan fight anyway, maybe we bring them in. But I don't think they want to take that step just quite yet. I think if they do that, they do it towards the end of their evidence gathering phase, which is like looking towards the end of this month, I think.
There was an interesting nugget in one of the texts from the Oath Keepers founder, Stuart Rhodes, and it seems to add someone he identified as, quote, an event producer for Stop the Steal, but that name, as you see there on the screen, was actually redacted. What do we know about that, and why might that name actually be redacted at this point?
We just don't know. It's a good question, right? I mean, this is the first time we're seeing the leaders of the Proud Boys, or the kind of the leadership of the Oath Keepers, rather, talking about a Stop the Steal individual. And, you know, it's none other than Stuart Rhodes himself adding a Stop the Steal event producer, which we might read as almost like a rally organizer or someone connected to the events surrounding the January 6th rallies, to this group chat. And the second line of the text message you reference is really telling, because it goes, well, you know, he's going to help us determine who's going to do what in the, quote, creative chaos on January 5 and January 6. I mean, it's really remarkable and damning, and, you know, raises all sorts of questions about who this person might be. Now, it's possible, right, that Stuart Rhodes misidentified this person, and maybe it was a Save America rally person because they were kind of colloquially being known as Stop the Steal. But it's a really interesting point, and the point that he raises afterwards in the text about the creative chaos, I think, is most interesting.
That was an interview with Ari Melber did with a reporter who broke the story, and Hugo Lowell of The Guardian. And so if you're not familiar with the Oath Keepers, they're a militia group that were launched in 2009 in the wake of Barack Obama's election as the first black president. It's a Nevada-based nonprofit and was founded by a Yale Law School graduate and former U.S. Army paratrooper Elmer Stuart Rhodes is what he usually goes by. So this group has ties, and I'm actually reading this off of the Southern Poverty Law Center entry on the Oath Keepers. And the group has ties to other anti-government extremist groups, including former Arizona Sheriff Richard Mack, the founder of the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, CSPOA. And in my book, Stand Up, I go into a lot of detail about this particular organization and its disturbing ties to right-wing militia groups. And just how many sheriffs actually belong to this group. I think I went in the previous episode about how sheriffs are elected. They don't require any sort of law enforcement background, and many, many of them are members of these far-right groups. And so Richard Mack is a founding member of the Oath Keepers Board of Directors. and that's sort of their background. They have their militaristic group. Obviously, they're armed. They have national and state, county, and local chapters across the country. In 2014, which is 8 years ago, Rhodes claimed the group had 35,000 dues-paying members, and that most of them were current or former military law enforcement and emergency first responders. So, and the group does intentionally recruit these individuals to their ranks to capitalize on their skills and knowledge that they've acquired in their time of service. So, However, the Proud Boy leadership has been cracking under pressure. With these different cases, 2 weeks ago, earlier this month, news outlets trumpeted that a Proud Boy leader flipped on his buddies in a stunning plea deal. That's the headline. Charles Donahoe is expected to cooperate with the government as it investigates the group for the January 6th attack. So a high-ranking Proud Boy leader pleaded guilty, I think it was around April 8th, over his alleged involvement on the January 6th Capitol assault. So the plea, the first coming from a core group of Proud Boys accused of planning the attack, comes amid a recent wave of guilty pleas from Proud Boys involved in the riot. So you have Charles Donahue, leader of the far-right group's North Carolina chapter, pleading guilty to conspiring to obstruct an official proceeding, assaulting an officer. Donahoe is expected, so he's expected to cooperate and to basically help the investigation, identify more Proud Boy leadership and their involvement in the January 6th attack. He was at that point the third Proud Boy to plead guilty. And so in a single week, that was the first week of January, of April, I'm sorry. And so as part of his plea, Donahoe admitted that he was a leader of a core Proud Boys group called the Ministry of Self-Defense, MOSD, which convened for the express purpose of discussing an attack on the Capitol. So this Ministry of Self-Defense, MOSD, was organized within the Proud Boys to actually conduct an attack on the Capitol. Donahoe believed that storming the Capitol would achieve the group's goal of stopping the government from carrying out the transfer of presidential power. The DOJ, the Department of Justice, wrote in a statement following his guilty plea, Donahoe understood from discussions that the Proud Boys would pursue their objectives, the use of force and violence, right? And you heard the reporter use the term creative chaos as well. And so this is sort of a state in which they leave us rather stunned, and the rest of the voters stunned and unable to understand or comprehend what is going on. And this leaves them sort of an area to move and to make political moves to basically co-opt power from us, from the electorate. And so it's a pretty serious issue, and I do feel like it's not, I think it is important as voters, as people who have a stake in these outcomes, to understand what's going on, and not to allow them to use creative chaos and force and violence to stun us into inaction or incomprehension. So the MOSD, which once again is the Ministry of Self-Defense of the Proud Boys, their discussions are central to the DOJ's case against the Proud Boys. Prosecutors allege that Proud Boy leadership planned their attack in the MOSD chat group, even egging each other on while the attack was underway. Donahoe's cooperation agreement could shed new light on the chat group and its members. Among the named conspiracy members were Donahoe, the MOSD members, and the Proud Boys' then-chairman Enrique Tarrio, as well as Proud Boy leaders Ethan Nordine, Joe Biggs, and Zachary Real. So let's listen to some reporting on what this could mean to higher-ups in the Proud Boys. We have some audio about the plea deal of Proud Boys organizer Charles Donahue and what it could mean to other Proud Boy leadership.
Proud Boys, the right-wing militia group that's accused of organizing the January 6th Capitol attack, pleaded guilty today to two felony charges and has agreed to cooperate with prosecutors in one of the most significant cases to emerge from the insurrection. Charles Donahoe, the president of a local Proud Boys chapter, admitted to conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding and to assaulting and impeding police officers. Video evidence from January 6th shows Donahoe admitting on camera that he stole a riot shield from police. Another video shows the defendant, among several others, completely overwhelming a thin line of law enforcement officers who were trying to block their advance on the east side of the Capitol. Donahoe is the first person in the Proud Boys leadership to plead guilty. He has close ties to Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio, who has also been charged for his role in the insurrection. Donahoe's cooperation could provide vital information to prosecutors about the planning that led to the attack. With me now is our friend Paul Butler, Georgetown law professor and former federal prosecutor. And Paul, so the Proud Boys leader, he's got all these charges he's facing: conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, obstructing an official proceeding, obstruction of law enforcement, destruction of government property, assaulting, resisting, and impeding certain officers. That's what Tarrio is charged with. Donahoe, in his court documents, has admitted to the following. Donahoe understood from discussions that the group would pursue their goal of blocking the certification of the Electoral College vote through the use of force and violence in order to show Congress that we, the people, were in charge. Sounds damning to me. Your thoughts?
Joy, the plea agreement is chilling. In open court, Donahue confesses to organizing an attack on Congress and assaulting law enforcement officers. He admits that the purpose of the rally was to stop the certification of the election, and that he understood that violence would help accomplish that goal. Joy, we had factions of the Proud Boys that were operating as a paramilitary unit, and Enrique Tarrio was the general, but Donahue had 65 people on his team. This is yet another reminder of how close we came to carnage on January 6th, even more carnage, carnage in the cost of human life, and carnage in terms of our democracy.
And here's the question of how you, as a prosecutor, would use him, because Enrique Tarrio is the head of the Proud Boys. He hasn't pleaded out yet. He's charged with all of these things, all of these conspiracies. The idea here is that they weren't just a bunch of losers who decided to arm up and go attack the Capitol, that they had a plan that involved understanding that what they were doing could stop Congress from certifying the election and keep Trump in power, right? If he starts to point up and say, I've pleaded out, but look at that guy, look at that guy, look at that guy, how high could this go?
It could go all the way to the top, and the question is, who is at the top? So this guy is looking at 6 years, and that's why he flipped. Enrique Tarrio is now sitting in jail on those 6 felony charges, including obstruction.
That's the end of that interview. That was Joy Reid interviewing a former federal attorney about this case and what it means. And so you know, there's many plea deals taking place, as I mentioned. Earlier this month, also a California Proud Boy associate pleaded guilty to assaulting a police officer. Ricky Weldon, a California man, confessed to spraying a chemical agent at Capitol Police and hurling the canister at them. A day before Weldon's plea, West Virginia Proud Boys leader Jeffrey Finley also pleaded guilty to illegally interfering in the Capitol, entering the Capitol. Court documents show that he communicated with other Proud Boy leadership during the attack via a chat channel called Boots on the Ground. And other Proud Boys have previously taken pleas related to the Capitol attack. In December, Matthew Green pleaded guilty to a conspiracy charge and agreed to cooperate with investigators. Another man, James Giannakos, was not directly charged, but came under investigation after he left voicemail threats against a prosecutor who had been involved in a case against Tario. They searched his home and found a Capitol Police shield, an officer's body camera and helmet, and combat equipment. They investigated him in connection, and he has not been charged. He took a plea deal related to the phone threats and agreed to cooperate as well. So, and once again, I should mention that that these groups, these Oath Keeper groups, have been found to have, as I mentioned earlier, to be recruiting former members of law enforcement as well. And in November, reporting came out that after NPR, after examining documents that illuminate connections between a far-right group and law enforcement called the Oath Keepers, the closeness to law enforcement is no secret. And they did, there was an anonymous hacker obtained information in September from the Oath Keepers web servers and leaked tens of thousands of names of current and past Oath Keepers. And when they investigated this, they found that 13 of the names of the Oath Keepers on the list matched that of officers that are currently serving on the force in Chicago alone, 13. And so there is truth to the assertion that there is involvement by with these militia groups with the police force, with the law enforcement. And when I worked on my book Standoff, comparing the local sheriff's response to Standing Rock, where you have Sheriff Kirchmeier actively basically leading a militarized assault on a reservation, right? and you compare that to the very measured sort of relationship between the sheriff in Harney County here in Oregon and Ammon Bundy. You know, if you can watch the video on YouTube that Oregon media has up. I think it's might be OPB still has it up, but with them talking on the road together, and it's very much like very collegial. Do you know what I mean? And Ammon Bundy and his group, they were allowed to leave. They were armed. They were allowed to leave and come and go as they liked. They were not stopped. I don't know if you visited Standing Rock, but if you wanted to even come near the camp, you had to go through a checkpoint. You know, and so it wasn't like we were luckily the people were nonviolent. We weren't carrying military arms, right? And so there is a real difference. And then, of course, one of the things I go through my book a lot is Bundy and his crew, their belief in the sheriff being the supreme. They believe in this thing called the county supremacy, which is a legal idea where the county is the ultimate authority in within the county, right? So the sheriff is the ultimate authority within the county, within the boundaries of the county. More so than the President of the United States, more so than Congress, more so than the state legislature or the governor or anyone else. The sheriff is the ultimate decider of everything. And they trace this, and I do a lot of explanation and examination in my book about their belief that in they're going back to old English common law, you know, Anglo-Saxon law, right? And what they believe, and it's an accurate sort of take on Anglo-Saxon law that they have. They believe that in ye olde England, right, and when it was Anglo-Saxon before the Normans came, that the English people, right, the Angles and the Saxons, would elect these leaders, these sheriffs, and that it's written into the Constitution somehow as well. They misread parts of the Constitution, and so this is why they appeal to the sheriffs. This is why they're appealing to the local level sheriff, right? And this is why they were traveling when one of their members was tragically killed by law enforcement and by the Oregon State Police and Lavoy Finicum. They were traveling to another sheriff, I think in John Day, basically trying to appeal to him that he was open to this concept of the county supremacy ideology, right? So, and the number of sheriffs that belong and believe in this thing is quite astounding and very troubling. And so this sort of connection between law enforcement and oath keepers and these groups that are as you can see from the documentation coming forward right now, are actively seeking to violently overthrow our elected government is very concerning. And really, I might take a deeper dive in that in a future episode as well. And I wanted to also get to, Don, more texts have come out recently. And I want to talk about Donald Trump Jr. and his text, which may have actually implicated himself and his father in all of this. So let's hear the audio of that.
King's Court. Let's now talk about the royal fool. CNN is reporting, and this is CNN reporting, that Don Jr. texted Mark Meadows, who is the chief of staff to Donald Trump, ideas for overturning the 2020 election. Now, here's the key. He didn't do that on January 4th, 5th, or even January 6th. He did it days after the election. Just after the election. It's very simple. Trump Jr. texted to Meadows on November 5th, adding later in the same missive, "We have multiple paths. We control them all." Don Jr.'s strategy apparently was nearly identical to what played out, filing lawsuits and advocating recounts to prevent certain swing states from certifying their results, as well as having a handful of Republican state houses put forward state slates of fake Trump electors. Now we're starting to see planning, and they're not saying he wrote these emails, because again, royal fool, but he was sending them out, sending them to Mark Meadows. Your thoughts?
Emails that seem to concede that his father lost the election. And Joy, this is a huge development because it goes to criminal intent. Donald Trump Sr.'s defense in the impeachment trial, the second impeachment trial, was that he sincerely believed he had won and he was just trying to stop the steal. This text that Jr. sent out suggests that they all thought that the American voters were basically irrelevant on the issue of whether Trump had a second term. The text said, "We control them." And the key, Joy, now is for investigators to find out who we include. Is it Daddy Trump? Is it Mark Meadows? Is it Jenny Thomas? Is it Steve Bannon? But many of those folks, whoever sent this text, whoever approved this text, seem determined and fully prepared to keep Trump in office by any means necessary.
Long before even the December post by Trump saying it'll be wild, join me on January 6th, they seem to be planning right after the election, before the votes were even counted and certified.
Okay, that's the end of that particular one. So that was Joy Reid once again discussing the issue of these texts from Don Jr., who she calls the court jester. And basically how they implicate his father far more than they had admitted, because of course Trump's argument is that this was not premeditated, and that this was simply a response to him thinking that he had stolen the election, and their actions actually and the way they're talking about it and the way in which they are disregarding the American electorate indicates something quite different, right? And so once again, my name is Jacqueline Keeler, and this is American Standoff, and everyone's been quite quiet on this. I understand this is a really difficult subject and very alarming, you know, to think that despite the number of the numbers we're talking about, I think that the server that got hacked for the Oath Keepers showed about 40,000 members, Oath Keeper members, which is granted a small portion of the American population. And USA Today also reviewed the 40,000 name list and uncovered more than 200 people on the list who had ID'd themselves as active or retired law enforcement officers when they were signing up. And U.S. State was able to confirm that at least 21 of the 200 appear to still be serving in police agencies across the nation, and that in fact in California, the Riverside County Sheriff Chad Bianco, he paid a year-long membership in the Oath Keepers in 2014, and the Oath Keepers describe themselves as a nonpartisan association of current and former serving military, police, and first responders who pledge to fulfill the oath of all military and police to quote, defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, right? And so this is very concerning, right? I do encourage you guys to call in, though, and let me know what you think about this. It is very concerning. So the as I mentioned at the top of the hour, in addition to discussing the newly released cache of messages from the Oath Keepers discussing joining Michael Flynn's security detail, we also wanted to discuss some solutions. Like how do we stop stop the steal, right? How do we stop some sort of group that's trying to take over the country? I mean, this group is incredibly diverse. I think one of the, it's not just these right-wing folks, these far-right militia group leaders, former military and active law enforcement. It's not just Trump and his cronies, but it's also folks like Cleta Mitchell, right, who is a senior legal fellow at the Conservative Partnership Institute, and she chairs its Election Integrity Network, right? And she's a partner. She was a partner at the Washington, D.C. office of Foley and Lardner. She has been called one of the GOP's top election lawyers over the last quarter of a century. And she's an anti-gay eminence Greece, I guess, you know, the conservative movement. She's very far right, but she is also very, very much part of the Beltway mainstream. And she started out as a liberal Democrat in the Oklahoma State House, and she served in Congress in 1976 and 84, that's when she was actually at the state level, and then she switched to the Republican Party. But she has, in 2020, she advised Trump in his attempt to overturn the results of the presidential election. She supported the former president's inaccurate claims the election was stolen from him, and attended a call during which he told Georgia State Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to, quote, find votes that would overturn Biden's victory in the state. And so this is and this is ongoing. I mean, Trump is still extracting promises in exchange for his support. He has a huge war chest that he's accumulated of donations, campaign donations. I think last I checked, it was over $150 million. And he can use it however he likes, right? So he is extracting promises in these races, particularly looking at races like that of the Secretary of State, and we discussed this in a previous episode, that could have a say-so about the election, right? So it's quite alarming. And so we do look forward to that. Once again, I would like to encourage people to call in if you would like. I would love to hear what you think of this. The number, let me see, the number here is, let me see here. The number here is 503-231-8187. And yeah, so we've been discussing the Oath Keepers and the recent texts that were released on Monday of their role working with even members of Congress in providing security details on the day of the storming of the Capitol. These texts show a great deal of familiarity with many of these different folks who are very close to Trump, like Stone and others. And this has actually been previously seen in court filings before. Kelly Meggs, one of the Oath Keepers that was mentioned in the text, mentions that Kelly Meggs had been at Stone's house a few times, and of course they reference members of Congress like the recently elected Representative Ronnie Jackson of Texas, and a former White House physician to Trump, he has denied that he has any connections with them, but they seem to express a great deal of familiarity with him. And as we mentioned at the top of the hour, what are we going to do about this? The January 6th committee is looking at recommending the amending the Insurrection Act, and whether or not that would be possible or whether that would work, I think doesn't address the larger issue, which is what American Standoff is all about, which is how do we contend with the way in which U.S. history is informing the actions of these people, right? I haven't gotten a lot into the leadership of the Oath Keepers, like Enrique Tarrio. He is himself a Black Cuban American, and what role does that play in all this? I did have the opportunity here in Portland to interview men of color who were members of the Patriot Prayer Group, and some of their motivations. And maybe I will play some of that in those interviews and audio on another episode. But you know, how does white supremacy and colonialism work even on people of color, right? And when I interviewed a number of these men, they told me that they had been radicalized through their service, their military service. And when they came back from the military, they were meeting with other former military folks. Afterwards, they were sharing, their experiences, and they were also playing video games together. And in the midst of playing these video games, they began to become radicalized and organize these right-wing militia groups. And so they weren't they were just a small group of the larger group, obviously. But I was very curious, so I sought them out and wanted to talk to them about that. And they were quite, one of them was, he's a Black member of the Patriot Prayer Group. And, he was very dismissive of Native land rights. He just told me that, well, you guys lost, just get over it, that kind of thing. He was, just accepting the status quo as it is now was his focus, and not on dealing with the sort of the actual issues of that really are part of the story, the creation story, as I call it, the origin story of the United States. He was not interested in dealing with that, and was very dismissive of the existence of Native nations today. And so, as you know, we open this show with a land acknowledgement, right? And we have local governments that don't want to do land acknowledgements, like the city of Gladstone here in the Portland metro area, that is refusing to do a land acknowledgement, the city council, because they are afraid that could lead to sort of reparations, where they would have to return land to these tribes, right? And so, how does that play out, and what is the role of the military in this, and sort of the sociology and the social construction of law enforcement of that whole thing. How does that play into the mentality of these far right militia groups, even with some people of color, right, men of color primarily, and so I think that's another conversation we could have. I know that it gets very complicated, but I think it's really important to analyze these things. So thank you so much. I'm Jacqueline Keeler, and this has been another episode of American Standoff.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 11 a.m.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification.